Hello, and welcome to Doc Tell Me More, my podcast where I take an in-depth look at documentaries. My name is Mike. I am your host. This is episode 60 of Doc Tell Me More, 6-0. Take that, Babe Ruth. And as always, I am grateful to all you listeners out there, whether this is the first time you've listened to Doc Tell Me More, whether you've listened to all 60. Can't believe I've done this many episodes. This has been a lot of fun to do this over the last couple years, and I've gotten a lot of positive feedback from listeners, and so I just truly thank you all for taking time out of your day to listen to me. It makes me feel nice and warm inside. As I said at the beginning, this podcast, I take an in-depth look at documentaries. I am a huge fan of watching documentaries. I probably watch more documentaries than movies. And so if this is your first time, what I do is I watch a documentary, then I come on here and just kind of talked about what I've learned through some research I've done after the fact on a certain documentary, because a lot of documentaries leave a lot out, or they sometimes can kind of stretch the truth. And so I'm just here to try to balance that out a little bit. I certainly encourage you, if you haven't listened to my podcast before, go back through all my episodes and see if any of the topics interest you. You'll see that the topics mainly fall into sports or history, as those are my two main interests. So if those topics interest you, you probably will enjoy it. If you're looking at stuff like pop culture or maybe music or stuff like that, I'm probably not your cup of tea, and I'm sorry about that. I'm still about 20, 30 years behind on the current music trends, but that doesn't matter. I digress there. Right now, here in episode 60, we're in the midst of talking about the documentary, the PBS documentary, The War of 1812, and which is, again, a really fascinating war to talk about. It's not really a war that's really highlighted a lot in either the United States or Great Britain, the two main combatants of the war, but it was a war that really had a long-lasting impact and on both countries, as well as Canada, which at the time was a part of Great Britain, and also the Native Americans that fought on either side. So really interesting war that, after I watched the documentary, I thought it'd be really fun to do a little short series on it. So in the first episode of this little series, I talked about the causes of the War of 1812. In the last episode, I talked about 1812, that whole campaign and what happened during that year. In this episode, we're going to focus on 1813. Because yes, the War of 1812 didn't just last during 1812. It went a couple years. I find it fascinating that historians could not come up with a better name for the War of 1812 than the War of 1812. But I guess that doesn't matter. Maybe we can come up with a better name now. Something I really thought about when I was recording last episode, and as I've been doing some research for this episode, certainly as someone who is was born in America, lived in America, I kind of acknowledge that, although I'm not trying to do this, my documentary has a little bit more slant from the U.S. perspective than the British perspective or the Canadian perspective or the Native perspective. And so I'd certainly try to keep it balanced, but I do think going forward, if you listen to me, it is probably going to be through the lens of the United States, not from the lens of the U.S. necessarily being the greatest, best country ever, but just more from the campaigns and strategy and all that coming from that perspective. So just wanted to acknowledge that right off the bat. And again, a lot of my sourcing for this episode and all these episodes in the War of 1812 is by the historian Donald Hickey, who is considered kind of the guru of the War of 1812. He's written a couple books on it, one called The War of 1812, The Forgotten or A Forgotten Conflict, as well as a book called Tecumseh's War, which talks about the role of Tecumseh and his battle against the U.S., which overlapped with the War of 1812. So I just want to give him credit there. So kind of some things I just wanted to point out before I get going. And I've kind of rambled now for almost 5 minutes. I'm sure you're tired of listening to me, or you've already fast-forwarded to this point and ready for me to get going. So let's get into this episode. Again, the PBS documentary, The War of 1812, really interesting documentary. I encourage you to watch it. But let's talk about now the year 1813 and what was going on in this war. So at the end of 1812, as you recall, the British had some major successes on land. They had taken Detroit. The U.S. was unable to capture Canada, which they had said before the war would just be a mere matter of marching. But then on the same side, in the sea, surprisingly, the U.S. Was able to defeat Great Britain in a number of battles, which was shocking because at the time, the British had the strongest navy in the world, and they still do have the strongest navy in the world going into 1813. So because of, the war stretching into another year, which was surprising to a lot of the U.S. Congressmen, which it shouldn't have been because most wars aren't quick, the U.S. Congress did a couple of things. They expanded the army. They doubled it to 30,000 regulars. They increased the pay of troops. They expanded their navy. They issued new taxes and new loans. And through all of that, really put a little bit more effort and resources into the war, something they really didn't do at the beginning of the war, which probably caused a lot of the issues that they had on land. And so you had the U.S. putting a little bit more effort into this war. If you remember at the time, again, Great Britain is still trying to fight Napoleon out in Europe. And so the War of 1812 is not a major focus for them. They're trying to do what they can to keep the U.S. from maybe capturing Canada and inflicting any other major defeats on Britain while they're trying to defeat Napoleon in Europe. And then if they can defeat Napoleon in Europe, then they're going to really bring their full might over to North America. So that's what's really going on between the two countries. Obviously, Canada is trying to keep the U.S. from overrunning Canada and annexing it. And the natives are just trying to survive. And they're picking sides either between the U.S. or Great Britain and Canada, just depending upon what they feel is the best in the long-term interests of their peoples. Now, the U.S. strategy going into going into 1813, the second year of the war, was kind of threefold. Number one, they wanted to attack Kingston, which was Britain's primary naval base near the Great Lakes. And they wanted to attack York, which is now Toronto, which was another naval base, their secondary one on the Great Lakes, and also attack Fort George and Fort Erie, which those forts defended the Niagara River into Canada. So really the goal with these three attacks, or hopeful attacks, was they wanted to control Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. And this was really the key to the war. If the U.S. could take those lakes, they would have a link between the East and the West and allow themselves to really easily transport goods and forces and troops and supplies to the West to try to recapture Detroit, amongst other things, but also would allow them the strong ability to eventually take Canada. So whoever controlled the lakes most likely would win the war. So the U.S. strategy in 1813 was to try to take those lakes. So let's see how they did. So looking into what is called the Niagara Frontier, kind of in the Canadian-American border, you had a couple of leaders, American leaders, that were going to attempt to take Kingston or take York. One was Isaac Chauncey. He was a veteran of the Quasi-War, which I had talked about earlier in the first episode. He had experience. He was given command of the naval forces on the lakes, where he was particularly focused on Lake Ontario, where he was trying to capture Lake Ontario as part of the U.S. plan. Another important American soldier in the U.S.'s attempt to capture either Kingston or York was Zebulon Pike. He's a name you might recognize. Pike's father was a Revolutionary War vet, so he had military in his lineage. He was really famous before this war for his explorations. In 1805, he located the source of the Mississippi River in what is now Minnesota. In 1806 and 1807, he explored the southern and western parts of the Louisiana Purchase. Now, certainly Lewis and Clark are more well known for their expedition out west to explore the Louisiana Purchase, but Thomas Jefferson, when he was president, also sent Pike on expeditions to survey the southern part of the Louisiana Purchase. During this expedition, he tried to summit a mountain, but had to turn back because of waist-deep snow. This mountain was eventually called Pike's Peak, so obviously named after him. Interesting thing about their expedition, they eventually wandered into Spanish territory. Remember that Spain's territory, what is now, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, parts of Colorado, California. That was Spanish territory at the time. He was actually captured. He was taken to Santa Fe, Albuquerque, El Paso, and eventually into what is now Mexico. There is some controversy about whether he purposely was captured. Some historians believe he purposely got captured so he could go into Spanish territory and assess their military strength. Some historians think it was an honest mistake, but he was taken to, he did take notes during the time he was captured, and ascertain Spain's military strength. Spain formally complained to the U.S. government about this expedition, but again, they just said it was an accident. Anyways, he was eventually released and made it back to the U.S. So he was already famous at the time of the war, but by the War of 1812, he was a general. So you had Isaac Chauncey, who was in control of the U.S. forces on the Lake of Ontario. He's a commodore. Then you had Zebulon Pike, who was a general kind of leading the ground forces there. Now, as stated earlier in this episode, the US's original plan was to attack Kingston, the primary British naval base. But they changed their minds and decided to attack York, which was less defended, so probably an easier city to capture, but it was less strategically valuable. So, of course, leave it to military planners to just take the easy way out. Now, York was the capital of Upper Canada. As I said, York is now current Toronto. It was on the shore of Lake Ontario. It was a crucial supply line between Quebec and the Western Outpost. So on April 27th, the 1813, the U.S. Attempted their attack on York. They landed and were supported by naval fire. The landings were only opposed by native warriors that were aligned with the British. Isaac Chauncey bombarded the fort by sea while Pike took command of the land forces, and Pike and the American soldiers systematically pushed the British back, who then eventually retreated and left the town to the Americans, which the local militia surrendered to the U.S. forces. So a pretty easy victory for the U.S. taking York. Near the end of the battle, the fort's battery magazine exploded, which that ended up causing 225 casualties, which was most of the 265 casualties of the whole battle. And that explosion ended up killing 38, including General Pike, who was killed in that explosion. So in total, there are 265 casualties for the U.S. and 400 for the British. There were so many wounded, though, that a surgeon said he cut and slashed for 48 hours with no food or sleep. So pretty kind of bloody battle there toward the end. I'm sure that surgeon practiced proper sanitary procedures as he cut and slashed for 2 days. Now, after the battle, and this is what York really became famous for, the Americans looted and burned the town for 3 days. The reason for this was they allegedly found a scalp, an American scalp, in one of the government buildings, but this was most likely made up and not true. Now, Pike had ordered that all property was to be respected in the town, but after he died, this was not followed. And the town ended up being occupied for 2 weeks. Now, the Parliamentary Mace of Upper Canada, which is a kind of like a how do I describe this? Just a government. Oh man, I cannot think of the word for this. I'm gonna look up better. A parliamentary mace is like a ceremonial metal or wooden staff. Excuse me. Just kind of, and the U.S. during this battle, when they raided the town, the parliamentary mace or the staff of Upper Canada was taken back to Washington, and the U.S. held that for 120 years when President FDR eventually returned it in 1934. I thought it was interesting. Now, the victory was a huge morale boost, but the U.S. ended up not taking Kingston. So it really wasn't much of a strategic victory. And the burning and looting of York ended up being a pretty terrible decision for the U.S. because the British would use the burning of York as justification next year in 1814 for the burning of Washington, which we'll talk about in my next episode. So the Battle of York was a success, and the U.S. continued their plan to control the lakes by looking to potentially attack and capture Sackett's Harbor. Now, Sackett's Harbor was the principal base. The Battle of York would end up leading to what was called the Battle of Sackett's Harbor. And that wasn't an American attack. Sackett's Harbor would end up being retaliation by the British for the U.S. attack on York. Because Sackett's Harbor was the principal base for the American naval squadron on Lake Ontario. So after the fall of York, the British hoped to attack and destroy Sackett's Harbor in retaliation. So the British got some intelligence that American soldiers had left Sackett's Harbor to attack another British fort. So they decided on May 29th to attack Sackett's Harbor with about 900 soldiers. Now, the Americans had expected an attack for a while, and they had built up defenses, plus had 1,400 men available to protect the fort. Now, the British were able to land successfully and had some initial positive momentum when they were able to initially push the Americans back after their landing. However, Mother Nature, the strong wind, kept the British boats from joining the fight, and they couldn't bombard the forts to help protect the land forces, or they were unable to weaken the American guns on the fort. And the American general, Jacob Brown, was able to rally his troops. And then the British commander, George Prevost, had to retreat back to his boats. So the Americans were able to repel the British attack. But a panicked American soldier, sensing they were actually going to be defeated, ended up setting fire to their naval stores and ships in hopes of keeping them out of British hands had their attack been successful. So this proved really costly and ended up helping achieve what the British were trying to accomplish anyways. So it was a failed British attack on Sackett's Harbor, but it ended up being successful because an American soldier got a little panicked, which I thought was hilarious. Jacob Brown, the U.S. general, his reputation was elevated. He'd end up becoming a general in the regular army and someone we're going to hear about a lot more in this war. Lake Ontario would end up being a stalemate at this point for a while. During this battle, about 300 casualties for the U.S. and the British about 265. Okay, so at this time, Ontario would be about a stalemate. The Battle of Lake Erie, on the other hand, the control for Lake Erie came to a head in September of 1813. The U.S. Gave command of the U.S. forces on Lake Erie to a man named Oliver Hazard Perry, which I think is a really awesome name. And so he was tasked with ending British dominance of the lake, which had contributed to a lot of successes in the war thus far for Great Britain. Now, Perry had numerous experience. He had been appointed a midshipman in the Navy at 13. Blows my mind. 13 years old, Let's see, I was what, in junior high? No way I could control a Navy ship. And Perry himself also experienced his first combat at 15. He also served in the Quasi War. Now, prior to the Battle of Lake Erie, Perry had a friend named James Lawrence, and he commanded a ship called the Chesapeake in a battle. During the battle, Lawrence was mortally wounded, and during this time, he really exhorted his crew to not give up their ship after he died. Unfortunately, they didn't really listen to him, and Lawrence did, after he died, the crew was forced to surrender. But when Perry heard of this, and heard of his friend's death, he had a flag made that said, "Don't give up the ship," and that was his battle flag that he carried into battle. So on September 10th, 1813, American vessels that were commanded by Perry, and then their British vessels that were commanded by a man named Robert Barclay, they ended up sighting each other on the lake and engaged in battle. Now, Perry's ship, the Lawrence, was disabled, with 80% of his crew killed or wounded. Instead of surrendering, though, Perry got on a smaller boat, and his crew rowed him half a mile under fire so he could transfer his colors, or his battle flag that said "Don't give up the ship," to another ship called the Niagara. And so then, instead of retreating, Perry led this ship, the Niagara, back into battle, broke through the British line, and was able to force the British squadron to surrender. Americans suffered 120 casualties, British 440, with about 300 being captured. So this is really one of the more famous battles and moments in the War of 1812. You have a commander leaving one ship, rowing to another ship under fire, and snatching victory from the jaws of defeat there. Afterwards, Perry sent his famous message to General William Henry Harrison, where he said after the battle, quote, "We have met the enemy and they are ours. Two ships, two brigs, one schooner, and one sloop." I just love that. We have met the enemy and they are ours. So this was this battle, which is called the Battle of Lake Erie, or the Battle of Put in the Bay, which is a worse name than Battle of Lake Erie. So we'll just call it the Battle of Lake Erie. The battle was significant, as the victory changed the balance of power in the West and helped the U.S. recover what they lost in 1812. So they ended up having control of Lake Erie for the rest of the war. And that, along with that stalemate on Lake Ontario, which would eventually, the U.S. would eventually end up controlling Ontario later on, would really help the U.S. With their successes in the West. And also, again, just help them recover everything that had been lost. So 1813 was really known for a lot of the American success on the Great Lakes. So the U.S. had a lot of successes, obviously, on the Great Lakes. Things were going well for them there, but they weren't going well everywhere else. At one place called the Battle of Beaver Dams in June of 1813, the U.S. had decided to attack a nearby British outpost in order to clear the enemy threat. Now, prior to this attack, American officers had lodged at the house of a Canadian named James Secord, who had been wounded at the Battle of Queenston Heights, which I talked about last week. Now, while they were lodged at this house, American officers discussed their plan to capture this, or to clear the enemy threat. This was overheard by Secord's wife, Laura Secord. She then set out and walked 17 miles through the woods to a native encampment. They then took her to a British outpost, where she passed this information on to the British. And then 400 natives from two different tribes set up ambushes in the woods with 50 British. And then when the American forces came, the natives were able to surround them, and the British commander told them that he would not be able to restrain the natives, a common threat, if they did not surrender. And so the Americans surrendered. Over about 450 Americans were captured in what was called the Battle of Beaver Dams, and Laura Secord became an immediate Canadian and hero overnight. Also, the Battle of Buffalo did not bode well for the Americans as well. This is Buffalo, New York. Now, the U.S. had, I'd mentioned earlier that the goal of the U.S. was to capture Fort George. They ended up capturing it at one point, but then they ended up abandoning it. And then U.S. General George McClure, when they abandoned this fort, ordered the neighboring village of Newark to be destroyed. He gave the citizens a few hours notice and then kicked them out in the cold and then burned all but one buildings of the town down. So again, this was another example of the U.S. burning in another town down, which certainly enraged the Canadians and British. So then around this same time, then the British, under Lieutenant General Gordon Drummond, captured Fort Niagara from the U.S. And then another general, British general, Phineas Rail, ended up raiding multiple American towns. And then both Drummond and Rail decided to attack the towns of Buffalo and Black Rock, which they did. And then they ended up burning Buffalo and Black Rock to the ground in retaliation for burning down Newark. So just kind of interesting to me that you had both sides here, and particularly the Americans, burning down different towns with different inhabitants in it. So these weren't just military objectives. These were towns that people who weren't necessarily fighting lived, and both sides ended up burning towns down in retaliation. So again, some mixed success there in what was called the Niagara Frontier in the Great Lakes and kind of New York and Canada, the U.S. controlling the Great Lakes, but also running into some failures there and on land there that the British were able to take advantage of. So let's now go out west to the Western Frontier. And when I think about the West, again, you're talking about a lot of states that are in the Great Lakes now, like Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. That was the West back in 1812, 1813. So you can't talk about the Western Frontier of the war without talking about William Henry Harrison. So William Henry Harrison was descended from a prominent Virginia family. His dad was a governor of Virginia, and his family itself had been in Virginia since the 1630s, so almost from the very beginning of the Virginia colony. Now, he went to medical school for a while before turning to a military career. Now, he fought in the Northwest Indian War, which I had alluded to before, which was in the late 1700s. He was at the decisive Battle of Fallen Timbers. The Treaty of Greenville, which resulted from that battle and that war, displaced most of the natives from what is now modern-day Ohio. The bitterness of that treaty lingered into the War of 1812 and was a reason why some tribes, including Tecumseh, fought against the U.S. Harrison then started a political career and was appointed territorial governor of Indiana. Part of his authority was to continue to negotiate with native tribes to cede their lands. And so this made him an enemy of natives. A lot of the natives hated Harrison because he would negotiate treaties and force natives to give up their lands. And so a lot of times, a lot of the natives didn't know what they were signing when they signed it. Harrison, on top of that, was pro-slavery and tried to encourage slavery into Indiana, but he was voted down in that regard. Now, Harrison first met the Shawnee warrior Tecumseh, who I've talked about in the last couple episodes, in 1810. They would become intertwined over the next few years. Now, they would end up arguing over the validity in this meeting over one of the treaties that some of the tribes had signed. Tecumseh said that all the tribes needed to agree to give up their land, which Harrison disagreed. He didn't believe that. And the dispute almost became violent at that time, but intermediaries were able to keep things from escalating. Tecumseh at that time in 1810 told Harrison he would seek an alliance with Great Britain, and he went about trying to create his Confederacy, which I have talked about in previous episodes. And again, as I mentioned, I think in my first episode as well, Harrison fought against Tecumseh's brother, the Prophet, and defeated him at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811, which that's what began Tecumseh's war, which was kind of overlapped and part of the War of 1812. So after the war began, Harrison was put in charge of the Western Theater. The administration wanted someone else in Washington, but the state of Kentucky ended up making him a major general of the militia, even though he wasn't a citizen of the state, because they felt he could do a better job than whoever the federal government appointed. I found that very interesting, how a state kind of superseded the federal government there in their choice for leader. So Harrison, again, was pretty much hated by a lot of the native tribes, and was an enemy of Tecumseh. And he was the person in control of the western frontier. Now, looking at the West, one of the really two major, probably most famous incidents of the War of 1812 happened in 1813. And one was at what's called Frenchtown, or the River Raisin. Now, Harrison was tasked with retaking Detroit after its surrender in 1812. So to do this, he divided his army and gave command under part of it to General James Winchester. Now, Winchester was supposed to stay near Harrison's column, his army, in relief. But Winchester decided instead to send a force to Frenchtown, which was 35 miles south of Detroit. That force, under a man named William Lewis, attacked a combined Canadian and Potawatomi camp and pushed them out of Frenchtown. This is sometimes called the First Battle of Frenchtown. Now, Harrison wasn't happy that Winchester disobeyed him and sent that force to Frenchtown, but he was happy with the results. He ordered him to hold the town while he sent more troops to reinforce the town, as he feared for a counterattack by British and native troops. Now, Winchester's troops were pretty inexperienced, and Winchester ended up doing a really poor job reinforcing the town. He was warned a large British force was on its way to town, but Winchester didn't believe it. He didn't put out any pickets or sentries to guard the town. And so, you know, on January 22nd, not long after they had captured Frenchtown, a combined native force, about 800 warriors from 10 different tribes, and British, about 600 British, attacked the town that held about 1,000 American soldiers and took them completely by surprise. A lot were taken out, were sleeping at the time. The Americans were overwhelmed quickly. Winchester himself was captured, stripped of his uniform, and taken to the British. 400 of the 1,000 American soldiers were killed. 40 were wounded, and 550 were captured. British casualties were only 24 killed and 161 wounded. It's not sure how many Native Americans were wounded. Now, the British commander, Henry Proctor, quickly retreated with the unwounded captured soldiers because he was afraid that American reinforcements were coming. And so he left the wounded behind in the city. And the next day, on January 23rd, the natives killed any American who could not march to the next fort. Anyone who could not keep up on the march were killed as well. Anywhere from 30 to 100 were killed. And this is called the River Raisin Massacre. And this massacre actually ended up overshadowing the battle. It became a rallying cry, which people said, hey, remember the River Raisin. And a majority killed in the battle or this massacre were from Kentucky. Winchester really bore the responsibility for the defeat. And this loss of Frenchtown and defeat actually ended Harrison's plans to retake Detroit. So it was a major blow to the U.S. It would not be retaken until later on in the war, later on towards the end of the year. So a huge defeat in Frenchtown, or the River Raisin, by the American troops. Huge victory for the British and Native troops. So Harrison's, again, so that defeat was obviously really not a great look for Harrison, even though it wasn't necessarily his fault. Well, then Harrison would redeem himself later on in the year, in October, at maybe one of the more infamous battles of the war called the Battle of Thames. So after the U.S. victory in the Battle of Lake Erie that I mentioned earlier by Oliver Hazard Perry, British General Henry Proctor retreated from Detroit, as he determined he could not hold the area, And the U.S. ended up recapturing Detroit in September of 1813, about a year and a half after they lost it. Now, Tecumseh was not happy with this, but they retreated with the British as they depended on him for their supplies. In October of that year, Harrison ended up catching up with the British. And Harrison had about 3,500 soldiers. The British had 800, and Tecumseh's natives had about 500. And this ended up leading to this battle. On the morning of October 5th, Proctor formed a battle line with Tecumseh protecting his right flank. General Harrison of the U.S. ordered a frontal attack led by a man named James Johnson, which overran the British line. Many fled or surrendered on the British, while Tecumseh and his warriors kept fighting. Now, Colonel Richard Johnson, who was the brother of James Johnson, he ended up charging the native position. 15 of Johnson's 20 men were killed or wounded. Richard Johnson himself was wounded 5 times. But during this fighting, Tecumseh was killed. Now, Colonel Richard Johnson was given credit for killing Tecumseh and still is kind of given credit for killing Tecumseh. But no one knows for sure who did it because during the attack, he ended up passing out because of his wounds. Now, Johnson, though, would eventually win the vice presidency based on his fame for supposedly killing Tecumseh. There's another person named William Whitley who was also potentially credited with the kill, but we just don't know. Now, this was a huge battle. It wasn't just for the Americans, not just because of the American victory, but because with Tecumseh being killed, it really... The native resistance with Tecumseh and his confederacy that he built collapsed. So it was a major blow for British, and especially a major blow for the natives who were hoping to resist a U.S. victory and their encroachment onto what they felt were their lands. Americans had about 10 to 27 killed and about 50 wounded. The British had over almost 600 captured. About 15 killed. The natives had between 16 and 30 killed and unknown captured. Now, while scalping is a lot of times, and rightfully so, I can't think of the words. I'm so struggling with words this morning. Yes, when people think of scalping after a battle, obviously people think of natives. And a lot of native tribes throughout history certainly scalped dead enemies after battles. But Americans did that too in this war. And after the Battle of Thames, Tecumseh and other natives were skinned or scalped by American soldiers. Tecumseh's skin was purportedly made into a belt. So it wasn't just natives that would do kind of atrocities like that. American soldiers did that as well. As I said, Tecumseh's Confederacy collapsed and many tribes made treaties with the U.S. because they kind of saw them as a potential victor in their eyes. But there were some that fought against the U.S. the remainder of the war. The victory gave Americans control over the Northwest frontier, but not kind of the further west like Illinois or Wisconsin, in which were held by Britain to the end of the war. Now, Harrison, this really elevated him even more in popularity. He was considered a hero, although he later resigned due to a dispute with President Madison and Secretary of War John Armstrong. Harrison would be elected president in 1840, largely due to his military success in the war. So again, he'd be president. Colonel Richard Johnson would end up becoming vice president, not under Harrison, but under a different president. Now, in this battle, something kind of an interesting fact, the Burgoyne Canyon was recaptured. This canyon was captured during the American Revolutionary War in the Battle of Saratoga, and the U.S. had lost it a year earlier in the fall of Detroit, and it was recaptured here in the Battle of Thames. So the Western frontier, no doubt about it, a major success for America, for the U.S. in the War of 1812. All right, so we've looked at different frontiers of the war. We looked at the Lake Frontier, which was U.S. victories We looked at the Niagara Frontier. Niagara Frontier is kind of like Western New York and kind of that northern and north of it, that part of Canada. That was British successes. The Western Frontier was American successes. And now we look at the St. Lawrence Frontier, which is, you think about that, it's more like Eastern New York and north of that, Canada, like Quebec and whatnot. And so that's kind of the last frontier we're going to talk about. In late 1813, the U.S. decided once again to try to capture Montreal, which, if you remember, they failed the year before. Now, if they were successful and were able to capture Montreal, this would have probably led to the conquest of Upper Canada and an end to the war. And so the U.S. was, even though Canada wasn't a cause of the war, Canada is always seen as a means to an end. If they could capture Canada, likely that would cause Britain to negotiate in the war in the U.S.'s favor. So in order to do this, there would be two divisions that would be sent. One would leave from Sackett's Harbor and commanded by James Wilkinson. He had served in the Continental Army, but he was really not well liked by many and was even at that time in 1813 perceived to be corrupt. In fact, in 1854, 30 years after his death, it was discovered that he'd been a paid spy most of his life for the Spanish Empire. So just kind of hilarious that one of the generals that the U.S. had been depending on for this war was actually a spy for the Spanish Empire. Teddy Roosevelt would later say, "In all of our history, there is no more despicable character." So obviously, you can see where things are probably going to go here in this St. Lawrence campaign when your general is actually a spy for the Spanish Empire. So the other division, so Wilkinson would lead one division. The other division would advance from Plattsburgh in northeast New York, and that was led by Wade Hampton. However, he did not have confidence as his troops were green, and he was concerned about lack of supplies. So, as had been a theme a lot for the U.S. in this war, poor leadership was inhibiting their plans before they began. Now, Hampton marched north on the Chateauguay River, but was at a disadvantage as farmers gave British forces intelligence on their strength. So the British had all these spies throughout the countryside that were constantly telling them what the Americans were doing. The British also created many obstacles along the roads, which made it challenging for them to march into Canada. Now Hampton sent part of his troops around to circle around the British and try to outflank them. At this same time, as he sent part of his army away, he received a letter from the Secretary of War stating that the Secretary of War resigned and ordered Hampton to halt any attacks and make winter quarters. He couldn't do that though because he'd already sent part of his army off to attack the British. And so he decided to keep going. And those troops he sent off ended up running into British troops who launched an attack. And his remaining troops decided to attack Britain as well, but they were repelled. Both sections of that American army were forced to retreat. Hampton ordered a complete withdrawal from the field, and he sent word to Wilkinson what had happened. Wilkinson ordered Hampton to advance to move to Wilkinson's position, so to combine the armies and bring supplies to him. And Hampton simply declined, seeing that he could not execute that order, and he just decided to retreat all the way back to Plattsburgh, which is, I don't know, it's just funny, just pretty poor leadership. U.S. had about 85 casualties. British and Mohawk casualties were about 22. So just so Hampton's army was a disaster. Wilkinson's wouldn't fare much better. Wilkinson left Sackett's Harbor on October 17th and headed north. He was harassed by British throughout his trip until the two forces met and engaged on November 11th at what is called the Battle of Chrysler's Farm. Wilkinson sent a force to attack the British left, and they pushed them back a ways before they ran into another British line, which stopped them. One of his second in commands was killed, and really by the end of the day, the Americans were defeated pretty soundly in the Battle of Chrysler's Farm. And then Wilkinson decided to end his campaign and retreat. And the defeats at Chrysler's Farm and Hampton at Chateauguay ended the threat to Montreal. And so again, as happened in the Revolutionary War when the U.S. tried to take Canada, as happened in 1812 when they tried to take Canada, and it happened in 1813 when the U.S. tried to take Canada, they were soundly defeated. And Wilkinson himself would be later be dismissed from command. So you think about these four main fronts of the war in 1813. Great Lakes, U.S. won. The West, U.S. won. Niagara, U.S., or the British won. And the St. Lawrence, the British won. So kind of 2-2, you think about it that way. So kind of just like 1812 ended, 1813 kind of ended in essentially a stalemate or a tie. And the war would go into another year in 1814. Couple things I just want to quickly mention here, and things I couldn't really get into as in depth this episode. There was a British admiral named George Cockburn who raided the Atlantic coast in Chesapeake Bay, and he seized American shipping. He was raiding ports and disrupting commerce. He would become a significant player in 1814, who we're going to talk about next episode. But that was going on, some British raiding. There are not as many naval battles in 1813. I talked a lot about some in the last episode. Really not as many to talk about, so that's why we didn't talk about any naval battles. And one thing I'm probably going to talk about a little bit is what's called the Creek War in next episode. The Creek War was a civil war between Creek tribes in what is now the southern U.S., a lot of it in like Georgia, Alabama. One side allied with the U.S., another with the British. That started in 1813. It lasted until 1814, had huge ramifications for the war, for this war, but I'll probably get into that more next episode. So kind of like I talked about, 1813 was like 1812. You had successes for each side, you had failures for each side, and each side had the opportunity to really strike a blow, to tip the war in their favor, but they really couldn't, and which ended up becoming a theme for this war. And that's kind of where things stand here at the end of 1813. One problem, though, for the U.S. and a boon for Great Britain is that as 1813 turned into 1814, the British had defeated Napoleon in Europe and now could send their full forces over to the U.S. to fight the War of 1812, which did not bode well for the Americans. And we'll get into that next episode. I appreciate listening. Felt like I really struggled talking and communicating this episode for whatever reason. I apologize for that. I don't know why. But I still hope you enjoyed it and learned something. Again, you can follow me on Mastodon at DocTellMeMore at mastodon.world. Again, I thank you so much for listening. And in this episode 60, next episode, I plan on concluding the War of 1812 as we look at 1814. And yes, 1815, a little bit in 1815, as the War of 1812 would spill into four different calendar years. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you later.